You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for spending your Christmas here with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today on the show, we revisit some of our favorite interviews from over the last year. Coming up later, an advice columnist makes the case that manners still matter in the digital age. She's got some advice on what to do when people step out of line.
First, a new project out of central Wisconsin looks to capture the voices of a group of people that we don't always hear from, our state's rural residents.
Through a series of oral interviews, the People of Rural Wisconsin Project looks to share the stories of rural residents throughout the state and in the process answer some pretty big questions about the relationship between place and identity and why it matters in today's globalized world.
We talked to the project's director, Matt Groshek, back in September, and we started the interview by asking him to describe the project in his own words and what he's hoping to get out of it.
Right now and in the past, recent past, it's been about collecting oral histories from people that have lived in rural places or live in rural places currently in Wisconsin. That's the short version. I think it's also looking to really listen to people's stories and histories so we can understand better what's going on in those places.
Let's elaborate a little bit more on that. Why do you think it's so important that these stories get told, get shared?
I think that in our culture in particular, in other places, we sort of discount rural. It's often defined as what isn't urban. And really, Wisconsin, a large part of it is a rural place. I think that we need to pay attention again to the continuum between what's rural and urban as a way to understand all those places. And those stories help us shape an understanding of that.
Now, as you're talking to people and collecting these interviews, what kind of questions are you asking?
You know, questions really range from, you know, what they think rural is, how they came to live in a place, what their work is in those places, what they believe their life values are in those places. You know, their relationships with the land, I think, enter into this. In the end, a lot of questions have to do with identity and place. I mean, something that you've already identified.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of different people that you've talked to so far, the age range and, you know, the different professions? Who are they?
I mean, that's been pretty broad in some ways. It's across the state geographically. When the project began, Ed Janis, who is a public historian, initiated this project. He was very much interested in people who had been in farming, dairy farmers, and especially an aging population. So a lot of the stories come from people that are older, that live in rural places or have lived there. And some of them are farming. Some of those people are working in small towns in different sorts of jobs. It really depends on, you know, what was available and what contacts were had early on. So we do want to change some of that. I think right now we're looking to expand the project, and that's kind of where the project's going. So we look for more.
And when you approach someone to do this, what's been the general response? Is it, oh my gosh, yes, I'd love to tell my story, or wait, what? And it takes some trust building to get them going?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think people are eager to tell their stories, and I think people who live in rural places in particular may feel a bit disenfranchised by not having their stories heard. So it really depends on the person. Some people are very eager to talk. They're great at telling stories. You know, they want to do this. Other people are a little reluctant. I know I have neighbors that I've been asking to participate in the project, and they're like, well, you know, I'm not really sure I want to talk about this, or I'm not really sure I have a sense of what that is. And I always ask them as a question to start that potential conversation is, what do you think rural is? How do you identify yourself as a rural person? And inevitably, there's a moment of hesitation there where they try to frame that in their mind or bring to mind what things they value in a rural place that help shape that identity.
Well, let's listen to some of these stories. You talked to one farmer named George who knew early on that he wanted to be a farmer. Let's take a listen.
When I got out of grade school, I just wanted to go into farming. I didn't want to go to school anymore. So in high school, I was old enough, and there wasn't a law then that you had to go to high school. So I stayed home. I wanted to take up some kind of forestry conservation. Then I had to make the decision. Dad would be alone on the farm. He couldn't do it anymore. He was getting old. So what do? Stay home and help Dad, or do I go off to college?
So you spent your life as a farmer happily.
I don't know where the happiness comes in it.
Huh. What do you make of that one? He wanted to be a farmer early on, but he's not sure about the happiness. It's interesting.
It is. I think that, again, that person's life is as complicated as anyone's. I mean, we all struggle with this. What do we do? How do we make choices? What sort of choices do we make that impact our family or ourselves? You know, what do we give up to have something else? What gives us joy or pleasure? What's hard? You know, what's a struggle? Those things are questions that everyone has. This idea of happiness, it's elusive. You ask anyone this question, no matter where they live, and they're going to have a response that may be similar. How do we define happiness? What makes us satisfied? You know, how do we live a full and rich life in place?
Happiness is also kind of a word that's more in vogue now, I think, when you're assessing life quality than it used to be. It used to be you lived a decent life, a moral life, a good life, but it wasn't always about happiness.
Right. I mean, I think that's true. And again, I think that's another reason to capture these stories. How has that changing sort of value landscape or moral landscape even, you know, what does that mean? How has that been shaped in a prior time? How is it being shaped now? I know that I'm working with young people all the time, every day. And when I talk to them about what matters to them or what has meaning to them, that's shifting all the time.
Well, staying with George's story, he, I guess, faced some difficulties in school. He came from a bohemian background. His teacher wanted to Americanize him more. Here's another excerpt from that interview.
She would come by my desk. Well, she'd walk around the room, you know, and then she'd come to my desk. She would pound on that desk. What's the matter, kid? Ain't you got no brung up? This is my English teacher. And I'd look, oh, my gosh, can I crawl under the desk? And the other kids in the room would be going,
Well, that's probably a common story for immigrants, urban and rural, over the years from a lot of ethnic backgrounds. Have you heard other stories like that in this project?
Yeah, I think there's always something, especially from the older rural residents, that is connected to a sort of transition into a different kind of place. You know, and often that transitions between rural and urban or a place that's not rural. Often when they attended school or they were involved in some sort of labor that took them to a different place than maybe often the farm, sometimes just rural. So yeah, that shifting, that sort of story is often retold. I think the other thing is even in younger people, I know there is a sort of disenfranchisement of rural and a discounting. When I was working in Indiana and teaching there, I would ask students, you know, where are you from? What's your story? And often with some, again, trepidation and shame even, they'd say, I'm from a rural place. You know, my family grows peanuts or soybeans or whatever. And so, again, I think often the attitude is by people that may be very proud to have grown up and lived in a rural place when they reach a point where they're encountering a different sort of population of people with a different background, they have to rethink how that's viewed.
And I want to hear a little more from this project. Now, one of the other people you talked to spoke of land conservation as not just a way of life, but something that should be revered, respected, and passed on. Here's a clip from that.
It was a given that you were, you know, God had provided you with this land, and it was your obligation to take care of it. You would learn it from the pulpit. You would learn it from your ancestors, so to speak. They would sort of pass it along, that this was a given, that this was something that you would continue.
And Matt, that idea of the land, how did that evolve as you talked to more people?
Well, I think that, again, there was a particular time in our more recent history where the idea of land use, and in particular in relation to agricultural use, was pretty well grounded as an identity in rural Wisconsin. And I think now, you know, and I think when I talk to people that are younger, they recognize the contested landscape of the rural landscape. And if you listen to the news or attend to politics at all, you see that those contested territories impact rural people probably most significantly. So there's a shift now where people are trying to understand, you know, what does it mean to have a job in a rural place? How is that tied into resources in a landscape that I live in? How do I preserve that landscape or not to maintain its rural character? Again, what do I value? How do I identify with this place? How do I identify as a rural person? So Again, that's changing all the time. And there's 68 interviews. I haven't listened to all of them. Mm. Certainly, there's a lot more in the archive that we've generated to date to certainly mine and look for some of those questions to be answered.
That's Matt Groshek with the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, which looks to capture the voices and the stories of the state's rural residents. We'll have the second half of that interview and more stories coming up in just a moment. First, a check of the latest headlines from WPR News.
We're talking about the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, which looks to capture the stories, the voices of the state's rural residents, and look at some pretty deep questions about place and who we are.
And Matt, we're talking here about rural Wisconsin. What is your connection with the rural in the state?
So I am a rural resident now. I grew up in central Wisconsin in a place called Rudolph, and I actually live there again. So I ended up leaving the area. Lived in urban places, Milwaukee, Chicago, Indianapolis, and now I've actually come back to the same property that I grew up on. So I'm, again, a rural resident.
Oh, what is that like coming back again?
So it's funny because people ask this question often, and they ask me about being nostalgic and sort of embracing or engaging that nostalgia. And it's really about coming around again to something that's very different. I mean, I'm a very different person. My life is very different than when I left here. The place is very different. The world is a different place. So it's very exciting to have some connections that persist, especially in the landscape. And there's certain attributes of that landscape that I absolutely love. So it's, for me, it's been really terrific to come back and to have a life that's very different than an urban life and still have some things that are connected to an urban life. So it's been great for me.
Let's check out another one of the interviews that your project has collected for a woman named Margaret. Nature makes her feel like royalty. Here's a little of what she had to say.
We went out into nature, and that was always our delight. I remember Eddie asked me if I wanted to learn how to handle horses, and he let me cut a field of hay, not a whole field, but at least he set me on this thing, and I thought, this is absolutely divine, the fragrance of the hay. And the blue sky with a few clouds up above, and here I am like a princess.
Wow. So just rapturous about having the opportunity to get up, lead the horses, and work a field and make her feel like royalty, though this is something that royalty typically probably wouldn't do. Do you get that rapture from a lot of the people talking about the landscape?
Yeah, I think that people communicate that pretty well. Often it's a bit subtle, but you know, other times there's certainly an exuberance about that. I think people describe a kind of rush in experiencing things that are larger than themselves. They're not human. It reminds them of maybe a context that they don't dominate, that something else dominates. And I think people have a rich appreciation for that live in rural places. Often that's a big part of the interview.
Do you think that that is a surprise maybe for people who themselves don't live in rural areas, that there is such passion to the place where these people live? It's not an incidental choice. It's not a failure. It's not somewhere they just landed. It's intention, and it's also joy, like we heard.
Yeah, I think people in urban places, if they've never lived in a rural place, or if a rural place is only that space you drive through as fast as you can to get to an urban place, you know, they may struggle with understanding what that is. And the thing that also comes through the interviews, I think, is that's not always an incredibly beautiful, pleasurable experience. That part of the experience of rural may be that it's dirty, you know, it may offer a struggle, it may challenge someone physically or mentally or emotionally in a way that, and I'm not saying urban places don't do this, but it's different than, it's very different at times than what those challenges are in an urban place. And really this is about people who come from different tribes sort of trying to share stories. And again, it's the value of the project. We get to hear that voice, maybe understand it, find a resonance that is not us in those other things, and realize this person probably goes through similar things that I go through. Maybe the scale is different. Maybe the thing that drives that response is different, but it's existing in the same sort of manner. So,
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Brian with us in Cumberland. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Brian?
I do agree, just like the gentleman was talking, I did grow up in a rural area and then never actually left and actually live on the farm that I grew up on. We feel, me and my wife feel, and our kids now are growing in their 22 and 24, that their lives have been very well grounded with the rural community and being on a farm, that when things come up in life and how things don't always go well, or, you know, with and when you grow cattle and stuff, sometimes cattle do not make it, and the kids are very well grounded in life, I think,
Brian,
growing up in a rural area.
Brian, thank you so much for calling. So, Matt, this idea of this is a great place to raise kids, it really connects them with the planet in a way and with reality. Do you hear that a lot?
Yes, I think that comes through often. I think people, and again, this is sometimes about the hardships that you encounter if you live a rural life. And it may be that you're not a farmer, but you're going to see things die. You're going to see things suffer. You're going to see things fail that might be more immediate in their impact in relation to your life in particular. I think, again, urban places have some of the same conditions, but there's often a buffer there. So yes, I think one of the things we're hearing from people is that, you know, raising a family in those particular places has been important, especially. And again, I'm informally asking people some of these questions before I would do an interview with them, and it comes up often.
We're going to hear from another one of your voices now. This is Loretta, a 92-year-old Wisconsin woman who's known to her friends as Dimp.
I don't like the city at all. I always said that I don't want to live in the city at all. My sister, she's dead now, but she lived in Richland Center. And I said, I used to go down there and visit her, and I thought, how in the world can she stand living in town? One time my husband and I took a trip to Canada, and we got up there and everybody talked French. We decided to come back home.
That's awesome. She's got such such joie de vivre, and she expresses herself pretty well. What was she like?
And again, I did not meet Dimp. My experience of her is through that interview. So I can't, you know, I can't speak to that personally. But when I hear this, I hear, again, someone who in some ways I think has made up her mind about where she wants to be and the people she wants to be around. In some ways, it might suggest a kind of narrow viewpoint. But again, I think that's common to everyone. You decide, you know, what tribe you want to be around, and where that tribe lives might drive that very much so. So I think there's a delightfulness in how she puts that desire to live in a place. This other notion about I could never live in a city, you hear, again, it's one of the things we hear. I would never want to live there. I've never have decided to move to a city. And again, I think there's another place where do we really represent the urban very well to people that live in rural places, because there's a richness in that in rural places and urban places that, you know, can be found if you have to look for it or if you find yourself in those places. So,
you know, we hear in Wisconsin of a divide. Sometimes it's expressed as Madison and everything else, or Madison, Milwaukee and Green Bay and the small towns and rural areas. Is part of this project, you know, trying to address that, to understand each other's viewpoints and cultures, and hey, maybe we got more in common than we might think?
Yeah, I think when I think of this project and I think of this idea of a polarity between urban and rural, I really think there's a continuum that ranges from, you know, a kind of sense of wildness to rural, semi-rural, suburban, urban, you know, post urban, if you will. There's really a range of experiences that people have. They're connected to place very often and identities. But really, across that continuum, you have relationships that go back and forth all the time. In fact, some of the research recently by some groups investigating rural conditions have found that a lot of people, you know, 100 days out of their year, they're working in an urban place and they live in a rural, you know, site. Or what they're doing is they're living in a rural place and they're commuting to an urban space. And so, and the other thing is we can't exist in isolation from any of those things. There's a mosaic of place and life opportunities across the state. Those things are all connected. in a way that's amazing. And I think we forget those connections, again, because we want to preserve some identity. So I think the project offers, again, a sort of maybe a fuzziness about, you know, what is it? What do these things mean? And where are they similar? And also, how do we depend on each other? This is about interdependence. And we have it all the time. We can't exist in isolation. I think especially now we have connections to the whole world. How do you frame your personal identity, your sense of place with something that might also include an identity that's a world identity? I mean, this is the question. These are the questions. They're interesting and exciting, especially in the 21st century.
Matt, thanks so much for sharing these stories with us, and we'll probably check in with you as you take it forward.
Okay. Thank you very much, Veronica and Rob. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the project.
That was Matt Groshek with the People of Rural Wisconsin Project. He joined us back in September to talk about why it's important to capture the voices and stories of the state's rural residents and explore the very human relationship between identity and place.
Coming up next is the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear from an advice columnist who says that rudeness of all kinds is at its peak in large part due to technology. She makes the case for a new set of manners tailored for the 21st century and says it's okay to call people out when they misbehave. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Hope you're having a great Christmas. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Today we're bringing you some of our favorite interviews from 2014. We just heard from Matt Groshek of the People of Rural Wisconsin Project. He talked about the importance of capturing the voices of our state's rural residents and how the place we live affects our identities as human beings.
Now we turn to an issue that seems to hit home with just about everybody these days, manners and etiquette. The days of Emily Post and stuffy etiquette advice seem to be over, but that shouldn't give us a free pass to be rude to people. But why does it seem like we can't escape rudeness wherever we go?
Our next guest wanted to lay out a set of etiquette advice tailor-made for the 21st century, advice that would address things like texting at the table, barking into the cell phone while ordering coffee. She also wanted to let people know that it's okay to call people out on their bad behavior and why shaming people over their manners can sometimes be the best medicine.
Amy Elkin writes the Advice Goddess column, and in her recent book, Good Manners for Nice People, she points out that people seem to be ruder than ever before. So when she joined us back in July, I started by asking her why that might be.
Well, I say we're experiencing more rudeness because the truth is rudeness is the human condition. But the problem is we now live in societies too big for our brains.
And what does that mean?
Well, a British anthropologist named Robin Dunbar measured the human brain size, and he figured out that we have a capacity for about 150 relationships. And this made sense because we evolved in these very small bands where we knew everyone. And when you know everyone, they have to behave differently than if they're strangers. And now we live in these vast strangerhoods where we are around people much of the day, many of us, that we have never seen before and will never see again. And if they are jerks, they can do anything to you, and many of them do.
So they can just toss their garbage on your yard, or in your case, you thought you saw a guy peeing near your fence, and they'll never see you again, so maybe it's okay to be rude, is what our brains are thinking.
Well, you're basically no one and nothing to them, and that's how they treat you. And yes, so they feel that they can do this with impunity, whatever they want, basically. Be as rude as they want, act as entitled as they want, and nothing will happen to them. And I would like to change that, to bring back shame, basically.
What does shame do for us?
Well, we evolved to have a great concern for our reputation. And so even when we don't know people, if we make them feel as if everyone's looking at them, this enacts our evolved psychology where this would have been a problem. So I like to do something called web slapping with the egregiously rude, the people who aren't just, oh, I wasn't mindful, but the people who are tell you to, you know what, off, and they're going to keep their loud cell phone call going. So I like to videotape them and post it to the web. And even if they don't see it, other people who are terribly rude will see that and think, uh-oh, not I should be a better person, but I might get caught.
So you have to be pretty quick on the draw with your cell phone, but are you ever worried that someone's going to come after you when they see you filming them?
Well, I do it clandestinely when I do it, and I encourage that in other people. And also, I mean, you have to be a little bit prudent. If someone looks like they're a gang member and they're armed, maybe just let it go.
So what are some instances where you've done that? Can you give us an example of web slapping from your own life?
Sure. On my cute little street here in Venice, California, I'm a Midwesterner, but I moved here because there are palm trees and it's warm all the time. I'm from Michigan. But someone dumped all this trash, bags and boxes of trash on my cute street. And they actually made the mistake of leaving their name on and in the trash. I went through it Nancy Drew style with rubber gloves, figured out who they were, demanded on Facebook that they remove their trash. And when they didn't, posted about it on my website, naming names. And then they still didn't come pick it up. And so they were actually, it was a famous foreign surgeon and his wife. And they had sent these curtains to somebody in a very ritzy neighborhood here. So I mailed a sampling of their trash to their friend in the $2.5 million house saying, could you please tell these people to come pick up their garbage?
Wow. And did it work?
Well, it worked in the sense that it showed other people that there are people who are watching, that you can't get away with it. So I don't know. These people, obviously, I messaged them and everything, and their friend knows and told them. But are they new people? Are they better people? Do they care about strangers? Or do they just think they're going to get away with it? I think the latter is probably true. But they might think twice just because somebody is there to catch them. And that's been an example for them.
Well, you're using technology to shame some people. Technology also, you say, is at the problem, at the root of some of our rudeness. Now, it doesn't necessarily cause the rudeness, but we're not always using our technology well. What are we up against when it comes to technology and rudeness?
Well, we got all this technology with no rule books. When the phone first came out, they actually published a book about how to use it. And we're in the Wild West here. And so what happens, one thing is that research shows that a one-sided conversation, so a cell phone conversation, commandeers the brain in a way a two-sided conversation, like two people talking in a coffee shop, does not. Because your brain tries to fill in the side of the conversation you can't hear. Now, people don't know that. But what it means effectively is that even having a conversation in a low tone on a cell phone in public, it basically gives all these people, other people around you, what I call neural itching. It's really annoying to people.
Right. And there's some comedy based on that I've heard of, where people will stand and answer the cell phone questions, the other side of the conversation of people that are talking on their phones, just to illustrate a point.
Well, yes, I've done that. But the problem is that you can really annoy all the people who are already annoyed even more. You don't want to become part of the problem. And that's part of the problem with people in traffic. People want to videotape them. Well, you don't get to crash your car because some guy's a jerk, some other guy in another car. You have to behave as if the root of manners is empathy, which it is, that we have to think about, gee, how will that affect other people? How might it affect other people?
I want to talk about, when we're on the subject of the phone, want to talk about one of the things that is sort of the classic dilemma of our age right now. It's that you're out to dinner, you're engaging with another person face to face, but that person is on their phone a lot. They're checking their texts. Maybe something comes up in conversation and they want to back check it on their phone and make sure it's right. And before you know it, you know, it's them having an intimate night out with their phone and you're witnessing it. What do you do about that?
It's just terribly rude. Now, I understand if there's a conversation and someone says, well, why don't you look that up? That's different than what people do. And what people do where they're on their phones the whole time, this is effectively like bringing a legal pad and doing your office work while somebody else is sitting there waiting for you. It's really, really hurtful. The other person is just left to sort of look into their napkin as if they're searching for secret messages. They feel as if everyone's watching them. And again, it brings up the empathy thing. I mean, that's a really awful thing to do to another person. And I'm big on people not allowing themselves to be victimized. Now, if you give that person sort of an angry lecture or hurt lecture, then you're still acting victim-y. And so what I like to do in a situation like that, if that, my friends don't do that to me, I think they know better, but even if they're that rude, but is to say, well, you know, I'll be outside when you finish your call, you come get me. Because that makes the point without being all hurt and woundy about it. And that person, I think, will be more likely to see that they're being a jerk.
Now, you're a big advocate of speaking out when you experience rudeness. You think this is, you know, it's part of your shaming thing that you think will bring us all to heal a little better. But sometimes it backfires. Can you tell us a story about the time you saw a guy, you thought he was doing something unsavory on your fence, and it turns out, I don't know, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But what happened?
Oh, maybe, I think maybe you're talking about, well, there was a guy who was, and people treat the great outdoors like it's a great big bathroom where I live, and that's really not right. It makes it smell like a men's bathroom when it rains. But actually, maybe you're talking about the girl in the Volkswagen. There was a girl, we're real close to the street right here. She had opened her car window and was having a loud argument on her cell phone, on her speakerphone in her car. And this is like being in an auditorium and broadcasting to the entire block. And I normally know better. I try not to behave in a counterproductive, hot-headed way, but I was already annoyed about something. And I just came out on my porch and I said, "We can hear you indoors," or something like that. And this girl, instead of doing what she does when I do the right thing, which is matter-of-factly letting someone know, excuse me, hey, you know, you probably didn't know, but we're real close to the property line here. That tends to make people want to be polite. But my sort of angry reaction to her made her come up to my gate, yell for about 5 minutes straight, and then vandalize my mailbox.
So that didn't go down the way you wanted.
No. But I use this. I say in the book, I do not have perfect manners. In fact, I have substandard manners like everybody. That's being human. But what I try to do is look at things like that and use it as a learning experience for how I'm not going to behave again. And I have done that pretty much. Not done that where you just launch off at somebody and where you instead use that matter of fact, basically acting like you believe somebody has good manners and maybe they just didn't remember or didn't notice. And then you let them decide to behave well.
That's advice columnist Amy Alkin talking about manners and etiquette in the 21st century and how to deal with rude people in our lives.
We'd like to hear from you on this. How do you deal with rude people? Do you confront them over their bad behavior? What do you say? How do you do it? Or do you just walk away and complain later? How does all of this make you feel? We'd love to hear your thoughts on these questions, so head on over to the Central Time Facebook page, maybe while you're at the dinner table, and let us know.
We'll hear more from Amy Alkin in a moment. Right now, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on from WPR News. We're continuing our conversation now with columnist Amy Alkin about her new book, Good Manners for Nice People. How do you deal with rude people in your life? Do you think people are ruder now than ever? Or maybe it's just a matter of degree. What is your code of manners? Do you confront people when you come across it, or do you just walk away and feel bitter? And we'll go to our phone lines now. We have Paula with us from Oshkosh. Hi, Paula.
Oh, hi. How exciting. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments, actually, and I'll try to be brief. The one, I was out to lunch with a couple of very dear friends, one of whom we share the same birthday. It was a birthday luncheon, and both of them had their phones out, and they were texting and texting and texting. And I was frustrated. We don't live in the same city, and we don't get together very often. And finally, I said, put your expletive phones away. I mean, it wasn't a terrible expletive, but I know that wasn't the right thing to say, but I was absolutely appalled. We're all really good friends, and like I said, we don't get together very often. And I thought your columnist comment was so funny about, oh, look at this interesting napkin, because I was kind of doing that. I was fidgeting. And my other comment is, whenever I visit any place, a retail store, a clothing store, a fast food store, and I'm giving them my hard-earned money, they don't say thank you. I don't know how we've lost that. I end up saying thank you 2, 3, 4 times, and I never get a thank you. It's no problem or have a good day. And I'm just curious what your columnist thinks about that.
Great, Paula. Thank you. A couple of good stories there from Paula. What do you think about those two incidences?
Oh, boy, do I sympathize with her. And this is our impulse. This is our impulse, is to lecture people in the moment. And believe me, it is my impulse, too. But what's really important is to not act in counterproductive ways. And scolding people in the moment tends not to work, first of all, because you're shaming them. And secondly, because there are two of them doing this. This is a sort of form of reverse peer pressure. It allows people more leeway when they see that they aren't the only one. A more effective thing to do is to wait until afterward, or to take one person aside, and to email someone and say, you know, just in a not a very accusatory way, criticizing people does not make them change. It makes them want to clobber you, to let them know that you felt badly, because sympathy really works as a motivator. It's very effective.
But then you have to sit through the whole lunch while they're on their phones.
Well, it's a problem when there's a group. If you're in a group, I would talk to the other person there, you know, or either that. It really is just this thing of yelling at people. She didn't say what happened, but it tends to make for bad feelings in the moment. And so it tends to be ineffective. The people, they aren't going to become better people because you do this. And they probably actually will want to fight back and say, oh, but it's not a big deal. That's the problem. You make them defensive instead of making them change.
And what about the thank you at stores?
Oh, this is a generational thing with a no problem. People who are basically, I think, over 55 or 50, 55, 60, it makes them almost homicidal when someone says thank you and they say, when they say thank you and the person says no problem. But I think they're a little picky about that, because the person isn't indicating that it would be a problem. This is just a way of speaking. And so that's something that where people, I think people are too picky. But really, the thing where people aren't saying thank you, that's pretty awful. It's a convention, a nice convention. We look for that. It's sort of a dignity violation when you say thank you and the person says nothing.
Right. It's a bit of closure.
Yeah. And you can repeat the thank you, but in a nice way. See, once you get sort of nasty about it, then the person, again, it makes them want to fight back. And you can, the thing that may work, I haven't tried this, but is to say thank you like they just forgot to say you're welcome, in a cheerful tone.
And we're going to go next to Rose in Bayside. Hi, Rose.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a son who has autism, and over the years, we've suffered comments and stares and advice, and one of the things that has worked for me is to just say, you know, we're trying our best. Thank you so much for your input. And I think that serves to both shame and educate people.
Okay, well, that's a great approach. What do you think, Amy?
Oh, I think that's great. It's really great, because she's not scolding people. And her approach tends to bring up sympathy in people. I have a little friend who has autism, and his mother will, if she takes him, for example, to a school event, and she's very careful to not take him places where he is going to bother people terribly. They eat out at loud restaurants, for example. But she'll say to people, my son has autism, and to people around her, and, you know, I hope that there won't be any outbursts. We're working very hard on this. And if there is, you know, please bear with us, and we're going to go outside. And so this lets people know ahead of time that you aren't just a parent with entitled children, but that you're working on this, and it's something that's real challenging for both parent and child.
So that sounds like something that acknowledges something. You treat someone else as a person worthy of your time and respect by acknowledging you might be inconveniencing them, and then asking them to be patient with you.
Right, because people like that. We all have moments when we're sort of loud or we bother people, and if you seem like you care about that you don't just think, oh, deal with it, this really makes people much more likely to go along with you rather than think you're just a jerk.
All right, well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Rose. And we go next to Andrea in Kaukauna. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm calling to discuss a rude episode I had last night as a soccer coach. The opposing team, I had no subs on our team, so all my kids were on the field. And the three players that were subs for the opposing team were near me, close enough that I could hear them start to yell at my players. We were winning at this point. Treat them like dirt. Kick them. They're terrible. I'm just yelling mean things to my players. My kids are looking, the refs were looking out, you know, looking at these kids. Their coach never did anything. So after a couple minutes, I finally had it. And I tried to politely say, girls, I've heard enough. You need to knock it off. And that's as mean as I said it. And the coach turns to me, and he clearly could hear me say that, which I didn't even yell at. What did you just say to my players? And I said, I told them to knock it off. They are yelling horrible, mean things out at the field. And the ref immediately heard the discussion. And I'm a small female, and he's this big guy. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. And long story short, the ref came over. He's like, I've been listening to your players. It's completely all uncalled for. In our league, if you show anything unsportsmanlike, you're supposed to get a red card. By the way, these are U-12 girls soccer players. This is not a, I mean, it's a rec league. It's not competitive. I mean, technically it's competitive, but it's not on a, it's a recreational league.
Okay, so ultimately the ref sided with you on that.
Oh, completely. And then the coach acted like he didn't, never heard what they said. I don't know if then he feared that he would get in trouble. So later he did, while game was still playing, you know, came up to me. He did apologize then and said, I'm sorry, I guess I didn't really hear what they were saying. But it was, I will say, it was very insincere. And then those three girls, every time they subbed back out, then I could hear them, and they were very loud and were saying, well, what can we do? What? And then they insisted on coming as close to me as possible, and in a very mean voice, yelling, go yellow team. And I just, I was polite. I did nothing.
So you were getting some back talk there on that. What about that situation? Sports can be tough. There's a tradition of talking smack, but it sounds like, you know, it's crossing the line. This is supposed to be a game of sportsmanship.
Yeah, it sure is. And Andrea behaves so well because it is so easy to go off on people in this situation. And for as dismaying as it is, the behavior of the coach and these three girls, you should really feel good about staying classy. And that these people are not accountable, this is not surprising. There's something that we, a human bias called confirmation bias. You know, we like to look at things only that confirm that we're right and not look at things that disconfirm that. And this coach didn't want to believe that he or his team had done anything wrong, but they absolutely were wrong. And he knew that despite his insincere apology. And I love that he was forced into that, and that the ref, through your sort of classy and firm persistence, came over and finally did something.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Andrea. And Amy, thanks to you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That was advice columnist Amy Elkin. She joined us back in July to talk about manners and etiquette in the digital age and what to do about rude people in our lives. This is always a popular topic, so remember, you can keep that conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk winter sports. Just because it's cold outside doesn't mean there aren't activities to get involved in. From cross-country skiing to broomball, a winter sports enthusiast lays out some of the fun ways to get active in the coming months.
Our friend Paul Singer at USA Today will be on hand to discuss the year in Washington. He'll recap some of the biggest national political stories of the year and set the stage for 2015.
And let's not forget, it was a big news year in Wisconsin as well. Remember that governor's race we had? The contest between Governor Scott Walker and Mary Burke grabbed most of the headlines this year. We had lots of other action at the statehouse, too. Our assistant news director breaks down what happened in 2014 in Wisconsin.
That's tomorrow here on Central Time.